Hi, everybody, and welcome to eLearning with E2R. Our topic today is Recruitment 101. This is Christy, and I've got Mary here with me. Before we get started, a few reminders for you, as always. If you have any questions during the presentation, feel free to use the chat box, which is located at the bottom right-hand side of your screen. You can just type them in there. We'll do our best to answer them during the presentation, but if we don't get a chance to answer in the moment, we will reach out afterwards so that you can schedule a call to speak with one of our advisors. In case you missed any of our past webinars, you can find the recordings over on our website, e2rsolutions.com, and the PowerPoint presentation can also be found on your member portal. Lastly, we take this opportunity to remind you that all of the information contained in our webinars are an overview only, and it's not intended as an analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly should not be relied upon as legal advice for any given situation. As always, please contact us for any specific questions related to the information in this webinar or any other topic, and for the specific applicability of this topic to your workplace. Just a reminder, next month's e-learning is going to fall on June 26th, and we will be discussing constructive dismissal. Without further ado, let's begin recruitment. So the agenda today listed here, we're going to talk about job descriptions versus job postings. We get a lot of questions about how are these things different, when are they used, and then we'll talk also about some best practices for information to include in each of those documents. We will talk about pre-screening and interviewing. So there's no real legal requirement as to what that process looks like, but we will talk about, again, some best practices in both of those areas, including a discussion about human rights concerns and how they come into play throughout the recruitment process, specifically in interviews. Once, of course, we've made a decision on the candidate, we will talk about some of the practicalities about getting them on board, so checking references and then making the actual offer of employment to that person. Specifically, we'll talk about oral offers of employment and how to avoid potential pitfalls associated with those. And then finally, we'll go over onboarding of the new employee, so what to prepare in advance of their start date and some best practices for their first days on the job.
Okay, so to start things off, we get a lot of questions on the differences between job descriptions and job postings. So job descriptions are used within the company internally. It outlines the specifics of the position. So it can be attached to an employment agreement to verify the specifics of the role to the candidate. It can be used as a guide for performance appraisals. It can be used to differ one role from another, which can be helpful in defining pay or promotions. It can also be used in medical files when seeking information about accommodations. So we recommend the following criteria on a job description: the official title of the role, their department, who they report to, and the status. So the status would be if it's a full-time permanent position or a part-time temporary, examples like that. Have an outline of the duties. This can be broken down into categories such as financial responsibilities or managerial responsibilities. If it isn't defined, you can just list those duties. And are there any physical, mental, or analytical effort or skills that are required for this role? So does the candidate need to have the ability to lift 20 pounds? Do they need to have basic math skills? And then next, we recommend minimum requirements for the role. So does the role require post-secondary education in a certain field? Does it require at least 5 years of supervisory experience? Do they need a specific certification or license? Those are some examples. You want to include what would be a bona fide occupational requirement on the description, and we'll talk about those later in the webinar. We also recommend mentioning the key relationships this position would have. So who does the role communicate with? Do they have to speak with clients, the public? And then who do they speak to internally? Do they work closely with the president or the CEO? And then next would be stating the working conditions. So is this role a fast-paced office setting? Does the position have to work outside in varied weather conditions? And then we also recommend stating if there is any travel required. And if it is, how much, what percentage of their job, and then where? Is this within city limits? Is this international? All this information gives new employees and current employees a clear understanding of the position and what is expected of them. So that is job descriptions. So what is a job posting? So job postings are used externally to the public. It's an advertisement of the company and the role that you are looking to hire for. So you want to create a clear picture of the role for candidates when they apply, so there are really no surprises when they're interviewing. We recommend including a short bio on your company. So what does the company do? What are your goals of the company? If you have any company values or a mission statement, we recommend including this on the job posting. And I'll definitely talk about that later in a couple slides. Next, we recommend including the purpose of the role. So what is the role's function in the company? It can include a summary of the role if the duties of the role are generally understood. So that would be if it's a nurse or a payroll clerk, you can just give a general summary. If the title of the role is not universally known, for example, like an account manager, we recommend adding a list of duties in the role so the person knows what they would be required to do if they had the job. So we also recommend stating the status of the role. So is the role a full-time permanent position? Is this a maternity leave cover? If it is, how long? If it's a part-time position that may lead into full-time, definitely add this to your posting. And then we also recommend the hours and days needed for this position. So if there is shift work with specific hours, mention that in the job posting. So if it's outside of that 9 to 5, if it's 11 p.m. till 7 a.m., definitely include that so the candidates are well aware. And then next, we recommend including the minimum requirements for the role. And this is very similar to the job description. So does the role require a degree or a diploma? Does the candidate need to have access to a vehicle? Does this role need to, or are they required to travel internationally? Like I said, it would be very similar to the job description. And lastly, we recommend adding a statement about accommodations. So employers must accommodate applicants' needs related to the Human Rights Code for any part of the interview or hiring process. And in some provinces like Ontario, the duty to accommodate must be posted on the job posting under the AODA, so Accessibility of Ontarians with Disabilities Act. So duty to accommodate is a whole other topic in and of itself. So if you do have any questions about the duty to accommodate, please reach out to client care and we can discuss, any one of the advisors can discuss. Even if you're not in a province where this is required, like Ontario, we definitely recommend adding the statement. It's definitely beneficial to keep that conversation open with any candidates who are applying.
Just a thought on that. Sorry, Mary.
Yeah.
Manitoba has also passed similar accessibility legislation. The employment piece of it is not yet in effect, but it is something that we're seeing other provinces look at. So even if you are outside of Ontario, like Mary said, definitely a best practice of something to include.
For sure. And before posting, we recommend reading the job posting over and ensure that it's easily understood by the public. So are you using terms or acronyms that only your company would know? Make sure that it would make sense to an outsider looking in. And then one topic that we are asked about a lot is if you need to include the salary or wage range on the job posting. So at this time, companies are not legally required to include pay on the posting. It's really up to the company to decide if they want to include the salary or not. If you know as a company you can only offer a certain amount, then it might be a good idea to include it in the posting so there's no surprises at the time of offer. We'll definitely discuss compensation discussions with candidates later on in this webinar. So next, job postings. We get a lot of questions about recruitment and how to attract more candidates, so to get a bigger candidate pool. There's definitely a lot of suggestions to this question, but one of the cheapest and easiest ways to advertise your position is really to start with your job posting. I go through job postings a lot, and I do see a lot of times where you'll see just the duties, you know, the title of it, the duties and the minimum requirements. This can definitely be boosted to gain attention to your posting. And create interest. So some clients we work with have a really strong company culture and values that they work under and the missions they strive to reach. So adding these to any job posting or advertisement helps make a company stand out to candidates. Some candidates are looking for more than just a job and a paycheck, and many are drawn to the strong values and mission statements, and adding that to the job posting can give a clear picture as to what type of candidate you're looking for. And then are you a company that creates a unique product? Do you have a really interesting service? Advertise that in the posting. Add that to the short bio that you would put on the job posting. Another thing is the perks. So I speak with a lot of candidates every day, and we get a lot of questions about what are the additional compensation, what are the additional perks about working at the company. So what are your perks about working at the company? So it's not only there to retain employees, but it's also there to attract potential employees as well. So do you have things like benefits? Have an RSP matching program? Do you have flexible hours? If you're located in a city, are you close to public transit? Do you have free parking? Are there growth opportunities? These are questions I'm asked every day from candidates, so it's definitely something of interest to them. And so they're definitely worth mentioning on the postings to create interest. And the last thing, if you've worked with us to create a job posting, you'll notice that we'll usually add their website, add your website. So if you have a website, we recommend adding it to the posting. It's just another connection between you and the candidate. So for more on job postings, so now once you've had your amazing job posting ready to be advertised, where do you post it? Again, we get a lot of questions about where to post job advertisements. And our first question is what kind of budget, or do you have a budget for advertising? So depending on how specialized your role is and where you're located in Canada, advertising for your position can sometimes come with a cost. So if you're looking for a less expensive or free options, we recommend posting on sites like Indeed. Surprisingly, colleges and universities have free job posting sites for employers. So if you have an open role that requires post-secondary education, it might not be a bad idea to contact your local college or university and find out how you can post on their alumni sites. For more specialized roles, we recommend posting on industry board sites. So, example, if you're looking for an HR role, the HR Professional Association, or Chartered Accountants, the CPA, these sites often cost a few hundred dollars per posting per month, but can often bring better results. So you can also use sites like LinkedIn, which are paid, but will target those who have the requirements you're looking for. And if you're looking for entry-level jobs or doing mass hiring, we're talking about dozens, maybe over 50, it's not a bad idea to look into having a booth at a job fair or creating your own job fair, depending on where you're located in Canada. So some job fairs can be a few hundred dollars to have a booth, but it can provide you with an opportunity to meet with hundreds of candidates in a very short period of time, which is definitely beneficial if you're mass hiring for a season or something like that. If you do have any questions on a specific role and where to post, you can always talk to one of our HR advisors. We can definitely work out, or we can work through that for you with the job that you're looking to advertise. So after you have posted the job posting and you're starting to receive applications, what is next? So this phase of the interview process is the pre-screening phase. It includes resume screening, and it can include initial phone screens. So if you've ever had to hire for anyone, I'm sure most of you would say that screening resumes can be one of the most time-consuming parts of the recruitment process. Depending on the job, you can receive upwards of 500 or 600 or 700 resumes. I've definitely worked with some clients here that get that kind of response. We recommend setting a time frame in which you will be screening resumes. You can post the due date for resumes on your posting, or you can create an internal due date and stick with that. So when screening resumes, you can get lost in the sea of different fonts and formats. Remember to stick to what is important about the position. So to help create a list, when you're doing the screening, create a list of job qualifications and categorize those job qualifications as minimum or preferred. So minimum qualifications are ones that a candidate must have in order to do the job. So these are the things that you're looking for are on a resume. Preferred qualifications are the ones that would make someone a stronger candidate. So when you're going through resumes, beware of biases. So a candidate's name, where they went to school, their age, these factors can jump out at you when reviewing a resume and should not be part of your decision-making, given the human rights considerations. And Chrissy will definitely talk about that later. And obviously, resumes can't tell you everything about the candidate, and therefore, we recommend the next step of the interview process to be a phone screen. So while not required, an effective phone screen is probably your best insurance against pointless interviews. Without it, you risk wasting time with senior team members on interview applicants who may look good on paper, but are not right for the job. And so this is something that we can support with at E2R here. But if you are planning on doing the phone screens yourself, we recommend to consider the following when preparing for phone screens. So determine what really matters. Do you need this position filled immediately? Do you have a salary budget that's not flexible? Does the candidate need to have certain software experience or certain industry experience? We recommend creating a list of questions before the phone screen, and when interviewing, document the answers. We also recommend reviewing the resume before initially speaking with the candidate. So is there anything on their resume that you would like clarifying? The phone screen is the time to ask those questions, and they can be asked over and above those already predetermined questions you have prepared for all candidates. And then the purpose of the phone screen interview is to determine whether a candidate deserves an interview. So like mentioned before, bias can diminish its effectiveness. If you were impressed with a candidate's resume and you were already determined to bring them in for an interview, really that call's obsolete. So try to be as objective as possible. Asking the same questions of all candidates creates an even playing field, and you may learn some important information by asking the same questions of everyone. And lastly, be prepared to answer questions. So the call isn't only about candidates answering your phone screen questions. It's also an opportunity for you to clarify details about the position and the hiring process. Make sure that by the end of the call, candidates understand fully what the role is about as well as what the next steps are. Also leave time at the end to answer any questions candidates may have. And don't be surprised if they ask questions about the role, but maybe the compensation or who they would be working with. Taking on a new role and a new employee is a big decision for both parties, and candidates are interviewing employers as much as you are interviewing candidates. So don't be surprised, and leave some time if they do have questions at the end of that phone screen. So after the pre-screening phase, the next step is generally the in-person interviews. So before you start this process, determine the who, what, where, when, and how in advance. So determine who is going to be involved in the interview process. Is there only one hiring manager? Is there multiple hiring managers? Is HR going to be part of the interview process? Does the president or CEO have final say of all hires? These are things to consider before starting the in-person interview process. And just like phone screens, we recommend having a predetermined list of questions prepared for all candidates. And where are you planning on having the interview? For some people, it's obvious it would be at their office, but in other cases, it might be in a warehouse setting. So if you're in a warehouse, do you want to have a tour of the layout as part of the in-person interview? Do you have a head office and conduct all interviews from there? Determine where you're going to have those interviews. And when are you going to conduct the in-person interviews? Make sure all stakeholders are present at that time. Find out if someone's going to be on vacation during that scheduled time so there's no delays in the process. And is there a number of candidates you would like to bring in for in-person interviews? Be mindful that the more candidates brought in, the more time is spent interviewing for all hiring managers. So sometimes it's better to have less, but that depends on the number of candidates you have, so you can make that decision beforehand. Lastly, but just as important, how many steps are you having in the interview process? So do they only need one in-person interview? Do they have candidates complete a competency test, like a Excel knowledge test? Candidates often like to know in advance how many interviews they have in the interview process, or just so they can add it into their schedule. And in any part of the interview, whether it be a phone screen or the in-person interview, we recommend the following best practices. So under the Human Rights Code, employers have a duty to accommodate, and that includes the interview process. Let candidates know if accommodations need to be made, that you will work with them to make it available. And that can be as simple as if someone requires bigger font for a document, or if they need access to an elevator for those with difficulty using stairs. These are some of the examples of accommodations. And another best practice, create and review with hiring managers what you are planning on asking candidates in the interview process. Are the questions job related? We recommend sticking with questions that do not get too personal. We don't want to ask a question that could be interpreted as discriminatory, and Christy will discuss this later in the webinar. And like I said before, create a predetermined list of questions and ask all candidates these questions. You can always ask different questions specific to their experience, but we recommend that there is a predetermined list of questions that all candidates are being asked. And next, document. So document, document, document. Whenever you are asking questions of candidates, take notes of the questions you ask and the answers they gave. If you have a lot of candidates you're interviewing, this can help be a reference in the future. Also, if any questions or accusations arise after the job interview, you have documented the interview and what was said. It's a good reference for you in the future. So keep notes for candidates that are hired and for those who are not hired, and include on those notes the reasons for hiring and for not hiring. We recommend having an unbiased or unbiased decision makers part of the interview process. I've definitely worked in some industries where it's small communities and people get to know each other. We recommend making a conscious decision on who's going to be involved in the interview process. Another best practice, so we recommend creating a recruitment process for all candidates and sticking with it. You can always relook at creating efficiencies in your interview process, like taking 3 in-person interviews down to 2, but make sure that those are changes are made. It's the same across the board. So you don't want to have one candidate have 1 in-person interview and another one has 3. If someone doesn't get hired, it may seem there might be questions why. Lastly, there might be hiring managers or interviewers that will be part of the interview process who have never interviewed before. So we recommend having training for new and really existing hiring managers to inform them of best practices and answer any questions they may have being an interviewer. And so this webinar is a really good reference for guidelines if you're ever doing training for new hiring managers or new interviewers at your company. And then some of the questions, there are some recommendations that we have in an in-person interview. We'll talk about the areas to stay away from in the next slide with Christy, but as far as what to ask, we recommend the following. At some point of the interview process, and the sooner the better, we recommend asking about candidates' salary expectations. We have seen this question never be asked in an interview process, and when the offer is made, the candidate and the employer were not a match in this area, and the candidate didn't accept the offer. I know it's a really hard question to ask, but it can save a lot of time for both you and the candidate if you're on the same page in regards to compensation before an offer is made. As discussed before, stick with job-related questions. What are the experiences needed to complete the duties of the role? And then we also get a lot of questions on how to find out if candidates will be able to perform once they have the job. So a line of questioning is behavioral or situational questioning. The philosophy of behavioral style interviewing is that past behavior is the best indicator of future behavior. As such, behavioral-based interviewing provides an assessment technique that focuses on what candidates have done in the past, not on what they say they might do in the future. So an example of this type of questioning would be, so tell me about a time when you encountered a difficult customer. How did you specifically handle that situation? If you have any questions about what type of behavioral questions you can ask, we definitely have some samples that we can provide and help you create an in-person behavioral interview guide if you require it. Good ways to understand a candidate's drive is to ask them motivational questions. You can ask why they decided to leave their last position or what they're looking for in a new role. You can also ask, why did you apply for this position at our company? These type of questions can give you a better sense of what the candidate is looking for and whether this position would satisfy those desires. So, for example, if a candidate is leaving their last position because of lack of growth, and if your company is flat and there's no room for upward movement, it just might not be a good fit. So even though they might have the right skills and the right education, you know, be honest if you don't have that opportunity to provide for them. And so it may not be a good fit, but at least you've learned that before the hire or the offer has been made. We always hear about companies trying to find candidates who, quote unquote, fit the company. So that's a very broad term, and we need to be careful on making sure we don't ask questions that touch upon areas of discrimination. So we recommend asking questions that link to your values and attributes as a company you look for in a candidate. If you pride yourself on great customer service, ask about how they would act in a difficult customer service situation. If you have a culture where it's very transparent, ask them how they would present difficult information to your team. So linking questions to your company's values gives you a clearer picture on if they will be a fit with the company culture. We also recommend asking when the candidate's availability is. So some candidates have to give a certain amount of notice, and it's good to have clarity on when a candidate could potentially start.
So we wanted to touch on now some human rights considerations to keep in mind when you are interviewing. So Mary touched on a few times where this might become an issue, so we wanted to highlight this a little bit. So just a reminder, human rights legislation does exist in every province as well as at the federal level. There's a lot of overlap in terms of what's considered a protected ground, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, and it is being updated regularly. I mean, for example, in the last couple of years, we've seen gender identity and gender expression added in some provinces as a protected ground. Some other common ones are things like sex, sexual orientation, citizenship, religion, things like that. And the legislation, the human rights legislation, provides protection for employees and candidates against discrimination on the basis of one of those grounds. So like I just said, human rights does apply to candidates as well. You don't have to be an employee to be protected from discrimination on one of these grounds. So keep that in mind. In the interview process, anybody on the hiring team really needs to be careful not to directly or indirectly ask questions that touch on any of those prohibited grounds or maybe have the candidate reveal anything on those topics that may lead to a discrimination claim down the road. Of course, understanding that some questions are intended to be informal or like icebreaker type questions, obviously that happens a lot in sort of that small talk period of the interview. Those questions can still uncover information that we don't want that may expose the company to those human rights claims. So on the next slide, we'll talk about some examples of good questions to ask and maybe questions to avoid. So again, some of these are very obvious. I mean, hopefully it's not going to be one of your questions in your interview guide that you're asking an employee about their immigration status, for example. If you need to know about their eligibility to work in Canada, that's a different matter. Obviously, that's a requirement of a job. But in terms of whether or not they're on a visa, whether they're on a, you know, are they a Canadian citizen, what's your immigration status would not be an appropriate question to ask. Same thing for do you have any disabilities? What's important here is do you have the ability to perform the essential duties of the job? Beyond that, we don't need a list of what disabilities or, you know, what medications a candidate is on. I've had that asked before, which is obviously a problem. Are you married? Really none of our business. Again, not related to their ability to do the job. Do you have any children or are you planning to? Again, are we making assumptions about that person's level of commitment to the job based on their family status? So not an appropriate question. What's your religious background? If it's, again, this, we see this sometimes come up as, well, I need to know if they're available for a certain shift. Well, frame it that way then. What, you know, is the shift that is required for this job? Is that something you're available for? It doesn't matter if what their religion is and how that might be associated. And then some not so obvious questions. Like I said, there's a lot of questions that get asked sort of as an icebreaker or as a, you know, chit-chat piece of the interview. So things that may seem innocent perhaps, but when did you graduate high school? That's obviously going to tell us what that candidate's age is, not likely relevant to the position. What's the origin of your last name? I've heard that comment before in interviews, you know, just really genuine interest. That's, you know, it's different or it's unique in some way. What's the origin of that? That's revealing that candidate's ethnicity, perhaps their background, not information that we want to have, shouldn't be part of the decision-making process. Even something as seemingly innocent as what did you do on the weekend? And I understand that this is maybe overly cautious, but the answer to that question could reveal something about the family status. You know, I did something with my kids, for example, or I celebrated a certain religious holiday. The idea here is that candidates are offering information potentially about themselves and answering those questions that might be potentially discriminatory or used as part of the decision to hire or not hire that person, that could cross into discrimination under one of those protected grounds. So again, sometimes candidates offer up this information sort of naturally as part of discussion. In those cases where that happens, what we would recommend is not following up. So it's not something that we're going to probe on or ask more questions about, and certainly not something that you should consider when making your hiring choice. As I mentioned, just all candidates are protected from discrimination under human rights as well as employees. So they could make a claim that they've been discriminated against and that was the reason perhaps that they didn't get a job. And we have a couple cases that we'll talk about later on in the webinar that highlight that. Generally, to succeed in that type of case, a complainant's going to have to show that they were qualified for the job, that they weren't hired, obviously, and that somebody who is no better qualified than them, but who lacks certain personal characteristics, perhaps, was hired, or that the job was reposted and the employer continued to seek applicants with the complainant's qualification. So that's where you might get into trouble. So just in terms of things to keep in mind, like Mary said, all the questions really should be job-related and well-validated. So consider, why are you asking the question? Is it related to their skills and the work? And then, of course, document everything. If you have a claim that comes up, even for candidates who don't get the job, keep those notes, those interview notes, so that you can point to them and say, you know, it had nothing to do with the fact that they revealed a certain religious affiliation, for example. You know, they didn't have X, Y, and Z qualities or experience, and we've got that record, that document that we can point to in support of any sort of claim. Now, one exception to asking these types of questions, perhaps, is when the question is related to a bona fide occupational requirement. So in some cases, we may actually need information that's related to a protected ground that is valid and relevant to the job. So typically, this is going to be something that the employer has to establish in advance, that any accommodation or changes to that standard is going to create an undue hardship for the employer. So it's not something that we can work around, essentially. It is a requirement. So an example, like a pilot, for example, needs to have really good eyesight. That's obviously integral in carrying out the duties of their job. Another example would be if you've got a position where there's alcohol service involved, that person likely needs to be 19 or whatever the age is in your province. So asking that person to make sure that they are, in fact, over that age might be another example. One other example that we use pretty commonly is if it's a question about gender, is it a reasonable or genuine requirement for the particular job? So the one example that we use is that maybe in a shelter for battered women, it might be a bona fide occupational requirement that the candidate be female given the environment that they're working on, and that might be a permissible question. So if you have questions about what might be considered a bona fide occupational requirement for any of the roles you are looking to hire for, we can certainly have a discussion about the information you need, maybe what's a more appropriate way to ask it, or if it is in fact a bona fide occupational requirement, we can chat about whether or not it is and what's okay to ask, essentially. So a case on this subject, I've got two here. This is, first one is a case out of Quebec where the Human Rights Tribunal in Quebec actually ordered the company to pay moral damages to a candidate who was rejected for a role. That candidate was asked some pretty direct and obvious questions during the interview. So are you a Muslim and do you practice your religion? These questions were found to have violated Quebec's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and the company paid $7,500 in moral damages to the applicant for the discrimination that he suffered. The tribunal did find that asking such questions was sufficient to prove the violation of the candidate's rights, and that the questions were not necessary to evaluate a skill or quality rendered for employment. So again, this is hopefully fairly obvious in terms of the questions. These are questions that are clearly related to a protected ground and were not found to be related to the job or required in any way. This next case is a Quebec case, again, from just last year, but it's more related to some, let's call it indirect questioning or icebreaker type questions. So in this case, the applicant applied for a logistics position with a Quebec company and was asked during the interview process about the origin of his last name. He didn't end up getting the position and claimed that he was discriminated against based on his ethnic origin. The company's position was that the questions were asked more, again, like I said, to break the ice, to lighten the mood, and their position was that that didn't justify breaking the prohibition against asking questions related to those personal characteristics. Their position was that they did a lot of business in, I believe it was North Africa, so they, you know, were interested to know whether or not that candidate had family there that they were still in touch with, for example, and that was their position. However, it was found that in the notes, there was actually, that was not a question that was asked of all candidates, so clearly not necessarily a requirement. And the tribunal awarded this candidate $5,000 in moral damages. So in this case, there was no follow-up. So again, they asked these questions based on the fact that their position was that they had operations in that region, but there was no follow-up as to whether or not that candidate actually maintained his ties to the region. And like I said, no other candidates were asked that question. So just something to highlight kind of the importance of good note-taking. So if this was a question that was in fact a bona fide occupational requirement, notes showing that the question was asked of all applicants would have been helpful in the employer's case, but that didn't exist here.
So once you've decided to make an offer, a common practice is reference checking. So some best practices in reference checking, we recommend it should be part of the employment agreement as a condition of hire. And so that would be on condition of reference, successful reference checking, as well as, you know, if there's other things, you know, maybe it's a criminal background check. And we recommend it should only be performed on the final candidate. We've been asked questions about how many references should one check, and so typically two or three. Ideally, you want at least one from a direct manager. So the key here is it really, the reference checking should be performed by someone who was involved in the interview process. Just so that if there was any red flags during the interview process, having that person that was part of the interview process do the reference checking can clarify any issues. They can ask questions like, how was the person's attendance issues, or what were there any attendance issues? That would be an example. And the same with any of your in-person or any of your pre-screen questions, have a set of questions in advance and document those. So if you decide not to hire based off reference checks, you have this documented for future inquiries. And Christy will talk about this in the next slide.
So more case law. We know this from, I mean, we have a lot of questions from clients about giving references, and as a result of a practice might make getting references more difficult. There's some fear, I would say, about giving references for an employee because of how it may or may not be held against them. So we get clients asking questions about, you know, what's appropriate and what are their risks. And this case is just a commentary on that issue. So this is an Ontario case from 2017. Ms. Canick was hired subject to a positive reference check for a position. Her former manager actually gave her a negative reference to the prospective employer, and that prospective employer rescinded their offer. Ms. Canick then sued Mr. Reagan, the former manager, for defamation. What the manager said about her on the call was that there was a lot of conflict between her, her supervisor, and other employees. She did not take directions well, and she did not handle stress well. He also said that he would not rehire her in a project's controls position, so specific to what she had been doing, but would hire her in autonomous financial position. So we had some qualifications as to whether or not he would recommend her for rehire, essentially. And as a result of that, the prospective employer rescinded her offer. The question of this case really revolves around whether an employment reference constitutes qualified privilege. So qualified privilege means there's no liability unless the statements made were both false and malicious. So the question here is whether the manager, Mr. Reagan, acted maliciously and in doing so nullified his qualified privilege. The court found that he did not act with malice and dismissed the case. So they denied the leave for appeal and essentially upheld the decision. The Supreme Court recently upheld that decision. Malice has to include knowing or reckless disregard for truth, as well as spite or ill will. So in terms of hesitation on your end for providing employees with references, just some things to keep in mind. Ensure the references that you're giving are based on objective facts and firsthand experiences, not something you're making up, obviously, and something that you've observed firsthand. Honesty is a good defense. So again, not something we're exaggerating, we're being honest, maybe using past performance reviews as support for that position. And use professional language and tone. So we don't need to go out of our way to throw that person under the bus necessarily. You need to be professional and try to balance the feedback where you can in terms of positive and negative. On the subject of reference checking, we are seeing more and more references sort of informally conducted over social media. So just wanted to touch on that as part of this process here. So some general concerns about social media. Obviously, I think we all know information found on the internet, we can't necessarily rely on that as 100% accurate. We can't necessarily take it at face value. We don't have any ability to confirm whether the candidate in this, that we're looking to hire is actually responsible for the content found on the social media website. So, I mean, a Twitter handle that happens to have a name, there might be a lot of, you know, J. Smiths, for example. So we don't necessarily have the ability to confirm whether they were personally responsible and whether the information is correct. You're sort of operating in a vacuum in that way. Another thing to consider in terms of a concern, just difficult to control the focus, the quantity and the quality of the information that's collected. So, you know, you're going on somebody's Facebook page, scrolling through photos, you may inadvertently find out more than you want to about a certain candidate, you know, see pictures of them attending a certain social function, religious function with their kids, et cetera, et cetera. You tend to find out more than you want to, and certainly more than you should be taking into consideration. So obviously there's some human rights concerns associated with that. Information is going to come up, like I said, related to any of those protected grounds that we talked about. And if someone in the hiring process comes across that type of information, even if it was accidental, you become vulnerable to the possibility of having a human rights application filed against you by an unsuccessful applicant. So they might allege that, you know, the decision not to hire them was based at least in part on a discriminatory ground derived from information that was acquired by the recruiter or the reference checker through a social media background check. Where evidence is clear that a recruiter or a background checker had access to that inappropriate information about the employee, it may be difficult to rebut that candidate's case and show that the information did not play a part in the hiring decision, even if it was subconscious. So legislation generally restricts an organization's ability to collect personal information to the extent that it's reasonable for meeting the purposes for which the information was collected. So similar to the interview questions, you know, how is this job related? What's reasonable? We have seen recruiters or employers requiring candidates to disclose usernames and passwords to social media websites, and that has not been seen to be reasonable because access to their profile is arguably beyond what's necessary to assess whether a candidate is a fit for a job. So definitely not a recommended practice in terms of checking somebody's background because of all those concerns.
So after you've gone through the interview process and you've decided you've found the right candidate, it's time to make an offer. So the employment agreement, we recommend that the employment agreement be the offer to the candidate because it sets out the terms of employment, things like start date, title, reporting structure, hours of work, vacation, et cetera, as well as the restrictive covenants, so confidentiality, non-solicitation. And most importantly, it outlines the employee's entitlements upon termination. So this is protection for the employer and the most important document in the employment relationship. And really every employee should have one. And so a contract can be created orally or in writing. And so Christy will talk about both.
First bullet there, beware of the oral contract. We get this question a lot. We know that offers are sometimes made sort of on the spot in an interview and just wanted to make you aware of some of the risks associated with that practice. So an oral offer plus consideration and acceptance is a contract. So keep in mind that oral statements made in an interview can be characterized as an offer of employment. And can amount to a contract enforceable at law, which of course could be problematic because you didn't necessarily cover things like the termination entitlements, which as we know is the most important thing in an employment agreement that protects the employer. So oral offers are binding contracts, so be careful of that, and make sure that you are in fact setting out the conditions of employment and the descriptions of new positions if you're going down that road. We've talked about this with many of you before, I'm sure. Offer plus consideration plus acceptance, that consideration piece is a contract, and that same thing applies when the offer is verbal. So quick case on this subject, RADAC, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that properly, against the Flight Network, Ontario, from 2008. Employee was interviewed for an open position and was contacted over the phone. The employee claimed that during the phone call, they were offered the position and that they accepted it. The employer stated that they asked the employee to come into the office to discuss an employment contract. The next day, the employee resigned from his current place of employment, did go into the new employer, and was given an agreement to take home and review. They signed it, returned it, and started the new job. The employer, Flight Network, ended up dismissing the employee within the 3-month probationary period without any notice, and was sued for wrongful dismissal. So things to consider in this case, was there an oral contract? The oral contract was in fact created during the conversation prior to that employee starting employment. And at that time, there is no indication that the employee's employment would be subject to that 3-month probationary period where no notice was required. Did the written employment contract vary the oral contract? So no, the written contract was given to the employee with no fresh consideration. And I know we've talked to many of you about consideration, fresh consideration before. And without that fresh consideration, the written contract was unenforceable. The employee was then awarded 4 months of reasonable notice. So even though they weren't induced to take the position with the employer, he did leave secure employment to take this new job and was terminated without notice, awarded 4 months. Again, a reminder to all of you, we've talked about this before, that short service employees are often awarded disproportionately more notice than that rule of thumb that you sometimes hear of 1 year equals 1 month of notice under common law. Short service employees get disproportionate amounts of notice awarded to them. So something to keep in mind. So in terms of avoiding the pitfalls about an oral offer, make sure that if you are going down that route, you're including the position title, estimated start date, and an overview of the remuneration package, so salary, benefits, RSP matching, anything like that. The candidate also needs to be advised that a formal written employment contract is going to be presented to them for their review and consideration. So there should be clarity about the fact that this is not the entirety of my offer. There is something in writing to follow. Any subsequent negotiations that occur should be documented for future reference to ensure that the contract, when it is presented, properly reflects any decisions that are made during those negotiations. So if you're going back and forth on salary, for example, make sure that that's documented so you can include it in the final agreement. And in the event that if the written agreement provides different terms or conditions than previously discussed, so things like the probationary period, any restrictive covenants, so your confidentiality, non-solicitation, non-compete, make sure you're providing fresh consideration for that employee, so a signing bonus, for example. Yes, and I just would say that this applies to, we sometimes see emails sent out, sort of quick emails about, we'd like to offer you the job for this much money starting this date. Same principles apply in terms of what needs to be included. Make sure that we are referencing a formal written employment contract to come. And just a quick recap on getting an enforceable employment agreement. Obviously, for the protection of the employer, the termination provision is the most important part of this contract. So if we are providing a candidate with a contract, it's going to be conditional upon the receipt of the written contract. Then we're providing them with the written contract, giving them time to consider the terms of that contract. They are signing it prior to their start date, and then we have an enforceable agreement. So keep all of those things in mind. If you've got any issues or questions with this process, obviously let us know, and we can discuss the particular scenario, what we can do to get the employee on an enforceable agreement if we haven't met all of those terms.
So next we'll talk about onboarding, and I know that we did a webinar back in September on this, so we're just going to do a very quick overview of it, but if you want to go into detail, definitely look back at our September, I believe 2018 webinar, that goes into much more detail. But so onboarding, so once the candidate has received the offer and accepted it, now you can start the onboarding, so getting the person ready to be successful in their new job. So some things that to consider before the start date. So like Christy said, making sure you have that signed employment agreement before the employer's first day. It's always, we consider it best practice to send an internal communication about the new hire's arrival. So depending on the size of your company or organization, it might be just an announcement or an email. For the new employee that's going to be joining your team, send details of the first day to the new hire. So, you know, when they should show up, or when their first shift is, you know, if it's a full-time.
As an HR person, there's nothing more embarrassing than a new hire coming in and saying, I assumed 9 o'clock was part-time. My manager never contacted me. Not a great way to start.
I know. I think we just assume in your day that you know, but for a new employee, these are all brand new things. They don't know. Sometimes companies take a new employee out for lunch to let them know if that's going to be part of their first day. So before that first day, create an onboarding plan to address training and proper introductions and designate that person. Is it going to be HR? Is it going to be their people manager? Also, we recommend ordering required equipment or tools or uniforms and make sure that set up their access and access codes and their workstation before they begin. And so on the first day, some things to consider from an HR and payroll perspective, whoever is overseeing the payroll, you want to review that social insurance number, whether that's in card form or document from the Canada Revenue. You want us to have a physical copy of or review a physical copy of that number. You would also collect that payroll information for direct deposit, have them fill out the TD1 forms, and collect personnel file information. And so not only that would include their contact information, but their emergency contact. On that first day, you want to review the employee handbook policies. And so if you worked with us on your handbook, you'll see that there would be a handbook acknowledgement form. Get them to sign that. And then also complete any benefits or RSP enrollment forms that would be part of their package. And so for first day, something to consider from a direct manager or people manager perspective, what would be their job specific training? So is it a day of training? Is it going to be a couple weeks? You want to have that direct manager review the initial job assignments and training plans for the new person on the job. Review the job description and the performance expectations or standards. If you have performance appraisals as part of your the working structure, is it going to be yearly? Is it based? You know, do they have it up the first 6 months? Let them know if they have a performance evaluation, when it's going to be. And then you also want to review their schedule and their hours of work, especially if it's not standardized, if it's different every week. And lastly, some onboarding cultural considerations. Some best practices that we recommend is having, if it's an indoor location, doing an office tour. If it's a warehouse, do a warehouse tour, and showing showing some of the practicalities. So where's the bathroom, kitchen, parking, where to get office supplies. It's amazing sometimes. I've definitely worked at a job before where I wasn't showing where the bathroom was, and that can be difficult. If you're in a city location or in an area with a lot of businesses, it's always nice to let new hires know where they can eat, where they can get certain supplies or that kind of thing, just on their lunch hour. You want to do a policy review. So the prime ones that would be initial for that first week. So timesheets, dress code, expenses, how to request vacation, and who would their key contacts be for things like computer issues, payroll issues, or any complaints that they have. And then also reviewing that if you do have a strong company value and mission statement, go through that with them. Or if you have a history of the company, it's not a bad idea to go through that with them to help them feel part of that team or your team.
So just wrapping things up, obviously an effective recruitment strategy and process is going to be pivotal to your organization's success. There's nothing worse than a long, drawn-out or ineffective recruitment process. Bringing in the wrong person is obviously very expensive. So making sure we get that right is important, and making sure that we are doing it in a way that is not exposing us to legal liability is also important. So hopefully you've learned some things on that front today. Just as a reminder, as it relates to the interview, just keep in mind those human rights considerations throughout that process, because it does, that protection applies to candidates as well as employees. Make sure that you're crafting questions in advance of the interview and making sure that everybody conducting the interview is aware of those questions and what types of questions are prohibited. And make sure you're always considering, why are we asking the question? Ask yourself that before you write it down, before you say it out loud. How does this relate to the required skills, to the job duties, et cetera? Remember the importance of the employment agreement, as we talked about, and be aware of the enforceability of oral contracts. And finally, a reminder not to neglect your onboarding process. This sets the stage for a positive introduction to the company and sets the new hire up for success in their new role. So, higher retention and higher engagement obviously means less money spent on hiring another new employee. So very important that you get that right and, start the engagement as early as possible. And like Mary said, we did do a webinar back in September that went into more detail about onboarding and some strategies to get that right that you can reference on the portal. And that's it. We will see you guys. If you've got questions, let client care know, but we will see you on June 26th for our next e-learning.